Good afternoon. I'm Beth Andrews-Beck. I'm a developer at TripAdvisor on our mobile team, and nothing I say here today represents my employer except that we're hiring. My topic today is pragmatic feminism. I went to an all-women school called Smith and got exposed to feminism and have found it super useful and helpful, and so I want to share it with a bunch of people who, you know, it seldom comes up in algorithms courses. But being a programmer, I tend to think of things in terms of systems, and society works pretty well in this metaphor. And in fact, I make lots of metaphors between feminism and computer science and things, because my first instinct whenever I encounter a problem is to try to debug it. And feminism is how I debug our sexist society. So throughout the talk today, I'm going to be using some book covers as backgrounds. These are various resources that I found useful. The point of this isn't to be intimidating or say you have to go out and read all of this stuff. It's just to give you a taste and flavor and some places where maybe you could go next if you are interested. And all of the information about what these books are and other resources are is on my blog here. I will swap back to this at the end, but bethcodes.com will take you there. So the central theme, sort of feminism to me, is patriarchy. It's this central design pattern of our society, which is the ultimate outcome of which is that men end up in power and women end up disenfranchised and excluded from it, which even that still talks about the outcomes, right? With some apologies to the Agile Manifesto, I think it can be better expressed as a series of values. This is, well, the thing on the, my left-hand side may be valued. The thing on the right, my right-hand side, is valued more. As well, we may care about other affinities besides gender. Gender becomes a central organizing principle of our society. Well, women may be important, men are generally going to be valued more than them if conflict arises. We have caring and nurturing may be valued, but there's also some sense of weakness there, whereas toughness is always good, right? And so from these principles and these messages that we're constantly reinforcing, we sort of sexist society arises. It's the emergent property of believing all of these things. And so you get things like, you get manifestations of this, like if you are referring to a default person, the little stick figure is going to have two legs. And then you want to make it female, you add a skirt. And so the default person is male, the unmarked person is assumed to be male, and women are a subclass of people. And thus, things that apply to half of society end up being considered special interest problems, rather than something that matters to lots and lots of people. And Sinfest uses the metaphor of the matrix for this, which I really like. It's the idea that all around us all the time, we have these values floating around. And we can learn to see them. You can learn to watch these things happen. And that doesn't necessarily give us the power to change them. They're still all around us all the time. We still have these little voices in our head that say we have to be both beautiful and competent. One or the other isn't enough. And so there's actually a whole series of comics about this website that I think sort of sum up very nicely how we end up stuck in this. And so whenever we're trying to change something, we're changing it while we're still living inside the matrix. We don't actually get to step outside. And so patriarchy isn't actually a feature. Like, it's been wildly successful for humanity. It sucks for us. And for a whole bunch of different reasons, right? Like, it affects different people in different ways. It affects different women in different ways. It's unfair, certainly, right? Men and women are treated differently based on basically a random die roll. It wastes a bunch of potential. Women who would be really good at computer science never have the whatever the happy accident is that lead them to this profession. Men who are would be amazing nurses may never get there. And so we've actually seen this as gender inequality decreases, there's a noticeable bump to GDP. Cool and measurable. And then on top of all of that, it's really hard for us to live in this society. Whether or not we justify it to ourselves, whether or not we explain it to ourselves, none of us are perfect examples of masculinity or femininity. None of us are perfect men or women. The box just isn't complex enough to hold half of humanity. And so there's this constant struggle between who am I actually, how do I feel, and how am I presenting myself to the world? And that stress takes its toll. That's what the feminine mystique is sort of captured for middle-class white American women at that time and place. A lot of this is very context-dependent. It'll depend, the actual manifestations of this depend a lot on where you are and who you are and what resources you have, but ultimately, it still sucks, right? And so the solution, or a potential solution, is feminism, which was the idea to fight back against this, to come up with some basic legal equality. You know, until 1972, it wasn't illegal to discriminate against women in engineering departments, which is why less than 1% of engineers were women. They simply weren't admitted. So when we look at older engineers, and why are there no women there? Well, because the law was the way it was. But if we're trying to sum up all of the opposition over all of history to this idea of patriarchy in a single word, again, we're going to run into problems with definitions. Who gets to define this? Who gets to decide who's in and who's out? Whose issues are central? Whose issues are considered fringe or extra? You know, you may have heard of atheism plus is the new thing, as though the issues of some atheists are key, and then some atheists have all this extra stuff, right, like being a woman. And so modern feminism, and certainly in academic feminism, you get some of this, we talk about feminisms instead. There's lots of different ways that people resist patriarchy. There's lots of different contexts in which people resist these ideas that are put upon them by society and these roles that are imposed. And so this sort of comes, the word in feminism is intersectionality. It's a hot buzzword, basically, that describes that how different women face these challenges differently. And there are different systems. It's not all about gender, right? There are different systems of interlocking oppressions, which is where intersectionality, the word, comes from, where globalism, capitalism, race, gender, ability, sexual orientation, cis, all of these different statuses come to play and influence how people will look at you, basically how you are inscribed, but how people see you if they come across you. And so not everything, there's still things that don't fall under this. For example, the womanism movement, which was an outright rejection of feminism, so it'd be really rude to like try to re-co-opt them under some umbrella definition. And those things can be useful, but for our purposes, from where I stand inside of technology and programming and computer stuff in general, what I generally talk about for myself is geek feminism. This term is very pragmatic. It was something that was come up with by practitioners who are working in computer fields, open source, hacking, maker movement, all of this stuff. Some of it is trying to expand the role or expand the definition of geek. You know, there's long been contention over who gets to be called geek too. You know, does Star Trek fandom count? That was a huge issue in the 60s, apparently, I hear. And so we in geek feminism, we're creating our own myths. we're creating our own stories of Ada Lovelace, and telling our histories again. These things that have been, if not entirely erased, certainly suppressed and minimized, and we've always been a part of computers from the beginning. The more we read about history, the more I read about history, the more clear it becomes that the very first conferences about computer science were 30% women. There are lots of the early computer science papers will be written by a mathematician who wrote no code. All of the code and all of the algorithms were done by the woman he thanks in his acknowledgement section. And today, she would be a co-author. But at the time, her name is relegated down the list. And so we lose out on this history. And geek feminism is one of the ways that, or is a nice umbrella term for reclaiming this notion of a technologically intelligent or technologically aware branch of feminism, and the ways we can use technology to oppose patriarchy, to break down patriarchy, to use radical online spaces in new and novel ways, right? The academic branch of this is called cyborg feminism, that does similar things in a lot more complex language. It's a lot less accessible, but I'll get to some quotes from that later. It's really cool. This isn't the only topic I could be talking about here, right? Like, I'm talking about feminism for software developers, which is useful, but we could also be talking about development of feminist software. Things like an archive of our own fall under this. There's neat intersections of open source philosophy and feminism and the ways that they talk about power. And so there's a ton of extra stuff that could be developed there. There's also feminist software development. I think a lot of the agile movement is really interesting if you go back and reread it through the lens of gender and the way we're creating these norms of how men behave when they interact with other men, because sometimes the patriarchal norms are really not helpful for actually building software. Again, though, mostly, you know, this hasn't really happened all that much because programmers don't really speak feminism and feminists don't really speak programmery. So there's other future things that I think are really interesting. But back to the matter at hand, we're dealing with kind of a sexist field. The Computer Boys Takeover is a great book about the history that I was just talking about, how things came to be coded as masculine, and how that form of masculinity was defined. So it was very much defined against, in opposition to the pointy-haired boss, you know, the business people, the people who controlled the gold and were trying to turn it all into a factory, right? And the people, you know, creativity was not something that's really coded as male. Collaboration and was not something that was coded as male before that. But you get the people who are coming in, you know, it's revenge of the nerds, right? Like they're really worried about their own egos. And so they create this new vision of ponytails and esoteric knowledge as symbols of gender. And what we get out of it is kind of, it is this problematic field, because what we see is that, so these are PhD. PhDs awarded in 2010. Less than 14, or sorry, this is employed computer science PhDs. Less than 14% of employed computer science PhDs are women right now, or this is in 2010. And it's not actually getting better. These are awarded PhDs from 2002 to 2010, and it's pretty much flatlined. Like, there's just, whatever we're doing so far, it hasn't really worked. Yeah?
Do you have any idea of
no.
A graph like that shows the percent of PhDs earned by women versus, next slide?
right here. So this is by field. This is all of the fields that the National Science Foundation breaks down, which is 27 plus computer science. And we're doing worse than all but three of them. And those three are electrical engineering, aerospace engineering, and physics. Civil engineering is beating us. So yeah, women now earn slightly more than 50%. I think it's 50.4% of PhDs in the United States. So we've got some work to do. Like, we've come to a place that's pretty stable. Like, it seems self-sustaining. I'd like to change that. And I think, yeah, the reason that I'd like to change that is predominantly selfish, my own experiences, but also because I don't think that we're getting all of the interesting computer scientists that we could be getting. I think there's a bunch of people out there who would be awesome at this job who would never choose to do it right now because of the way it's structured. And I think we can change that. So why is computer science different than everything except electrical engineering, aeronautics, and physics? And because a bunch of these other professions also require the same things that computer science requires, right? They require dedication, long hours, work-life balance, timing of children. You know, all the things that we normally talk about, if anything, computer science, you can go into software development where you're more likely to be able to work from home. You're more likely to have flexible hours. So if those were the solutions, like, we should be doing better than we are, certainly. And for my sort of literature review, I think the answer is ambient belonging. There's some citations on this, but the basic idea is that you can take women who are like college freshmen and give them a survey about how interested are you in computer science. And if you give it to them in a room with pretty landscapes on the walls and water bottles and lamps, they'll be pretty interested. And if you instead give them this survey in a room with a World of Warcraft poster and a statue of Darth Vader, and some like Cheetos around, none of them want to study computer science. And it's really like more women play World of Warcraft than study computer science. So you would think that this would be but no. Like, it's all about image and whether or not they think that someone like them would be studying this topic here. So first time you walk into a classroom and you are the only woman in the room, that's a huge turnoff right there, because you're instantly marked as other and special and weird, and maybe this isn't the place for you. And so we get this sense of ambient alienation, where instead of having the sense of, I found my home and it's full of cool puzzles to solve, you get, oh my God, I'm so weird. And unfortunately, at the same time, sexists who come into this field see the /dot comments, and they see the Hacker News comments, and they see the guys standing up for sexist behavior, and they think, I've come home. I have a place where I can believe all these terrible things about women because I've never been forced to interact with them by society. And so they stick around, which creates a self-perpetuating cycle where women leave. And we do have some things that are sort of unique to our field that talk about our form of patriarchy is a little bit different. This is a quote from an old story of the hardcore coder who carefully timed everything on the read heads and used buffer overflows to break his loops and all sorts of terrible things, right? But the way patriarchy looks in computer science is that we care more about code than we do about whether or not you can talk about your code. We care more about back-end code than front-end code. Nobody, like, how many people, you know, really understand CSS box model when they graduate with a CS degree? And how sad is that, right? And we give prestige to lower level languages and security research over human computer interface. You know, and we care about functionality versus whether anyone is ever going to use it. It's this really cool feature that takes 15 menus to get to. It's really not going to be that important, except that that's where we put our values. And the big one, of course, is that we care more about having women around to date than we do about having women around as peers. And it's happening less and less as people get pushback, but when we first started talking about women in computer science, often you'd get the response of, well, I would love to have more women around, maybe then I could get it laid. And this is terrible, this is, you know, exactly backwards. And so, part of this is just this notion of women in computing, right? The idea that there is something intrinsic to all women that we share an experience of computing. So Judith Butler here goes into these long critiques that are really dense about how gender is this construction that we believe we identify with without actually knowing what that means, sort of thing. And the problem with summing up the problems of patriarchy in computer science as women in computer science is that it erases all the women who are already there, right? Because you get headlines like, there are no women in computer science. And then we have to pretend everything is fine because to counteract those headlines, we say, these are the 5 women in computer science. And when maybe those women would really like to leave computer science because it's kind of awkward and lonely here. And so it's this, again, it's this sort of double bind that are faced by the women who remain. And also, summing up as women in computing tends to perpetuate benevolent sexism. These are the good, happy kinds of sexism where we want to protect and nurture women and, you know, not make them do all of the hard stuff, or, you know, we should be standing up and protecting them from the world, basically. And it turns out that this is just pretty much almost as harmful as hostile sexism in terms of actually achieving gender equality. Believing that women are on a pedestal somewhere is terrible. It's it's awful for actually organizing anything. And basically, in a field that is 88% men, if we're going to target our cultural interventions and we target them just at the 22%, we're not going to get very far. We have to address men's behavior and we have to address men's relationship to patriarchy, I think, if we're going to have any fundamental long-term changes. This also, there's a lot of ways that women differ. One of them is age, right? Like, so a little while ago in Boston, this woman, Jenny won a hackathon. Awesome, good for her. She was then given an interview in the Huffington Post to tell us all how to be women in computer science. She's 17 years old and had gone to the hackathon with her dad. I think it's awesome that she won, that's fantastic. But by using her to drive a wedge into the women in computer science movement, to use her to discredit the women who have been around for much longer, they're depriving her of her support network, right? And they're depriving experienced women of their voices. They're elevating her to a position of authority because she's comforting. She doesn't actually ask anyone to change anything. She says things are fine the way they are, because in her experience, they have been. The problem is that having computer programmers have more daughters isn't actually going to get us enough women in computer science. This isn't a scalable solution. And so we need to respect women's experience and expertise in the same way we respect men's and give young women a place in a community of women rather than setting them apart and using them to alienate the existing women there. And the ultimate solution is not to have women be able to act like men. This would achieve some form of equality, but it would deprive us of a bunch of human experience. It's not just about freedom of choice as long as the incentives remain really sucky. You know, you're free to choose to, you know, park someplace your car's going to get towed, but that's not actually freedom. And we know that even if we achieved superficial freedom, right now it would benefit men more than women. And it would benefit privileged women more than less privileged women, because they have more access to opportunity already. And so if we're going to address the fundamental issues, if we're going to get at not just patriarchy, but white supremacy and the glorification of attractive women over competent women, and so on, all of these other artificial hierarchies in the world around us, we need to step up and address those and not just try to get at some superficial libertarian idea of women being able to wear pants. So what would be the alternative here? I think we need to hack society. Social engineering is already taken as the term and means something else, so I go with hack society. We need to figure out what we want to change, and then we need to do some things and see if that fixes it, and if not, do try something else. Right? It's all about iterative community creation. So the first thing I think we can do is label sexism as sexism. This is from a quote from the Australian military, which is doing an investigation into some sexist emails going around. And I think it's very key, is that anytime someone says something around you that you don't agree with and you don't say anything, they probably think you agree with them. As long as there's only a couple of women who may be calling out behavior in public, it's pretty easy for the sexist to know who they are, target them, get them fired. But the reason that they're afraid enough to do all of that and to wage these denial of service attacks, just because the fact someone made a sexist joke was posted on the internet, is because naming can be powerful. The other trick is that it's not necessarily powerful. We have to have some consequences. And I think the best consequences are to make sexists uncomfortable. This doesn't have to be unethical. It turns out that trolling sexists is really easy. Often all you have to do is laugh at them. Or generally do something, just anything that shows that you believe that the people around you agree with you. And that's all it takes to make them feel alienated. So Jessamyn Smith had at her job, someone created a bot that would automatically respond with "that's what she said" jokes. So she created a bot that would reply to anyone who said "that's what she said" with a quote from some famous woman. And she called it "that's what she really said." And men flipped out. They didn't know why they were flipping out, they couldn't really articulate it, but they were really upset that suddenly women's voices were being injected into the conversation. And so there's nothing even really rude about this, right? All we're doing is asserting that we're here. And that's enough. And so this is part of why I think that feminism makes it a lot easier to confront some of these things, because we realize how banal what they're doing is. You know, when they say, "go make me a sandwich," how unoriginal can you possibly get? And then you realize, not that there's never consequences for doing these things, but the actual initial effort involved, at least, is not overwhelming. The next thing we can do is make it about them. If they're afraid, we can use that fear. We can talk to them about their fear. And suddenly it stops being about these hypothetical women somewhere and becomes very immediate. It becomes, feminism refers to these as like embodied experiences or lived experiences. So for example, one conversation I've had multiple times is, so if you can't hit on a woman at a conference, you're going to be lonely forever? Well, if you keep hitting on women at conferences, you don't get to come to conferences anymore, and you'll be even more lonely forever. Like, there's some very straightforward ways we can engage with the same incentives they're already facing and use it to assert some basic standards of behavior. And ignoring trolls only works if trolling isn't self-reinforcing. And the problem with sexism is that when a guy says, make me a sandwich, he already feels better about himself. He was feeling threatened before, he has projected his ego defense, and now he feels better. And if no one says anything, he'll do that again next time. Ignoring the trolls works if they're trying to get a rise out of you. If they're doing it for themselves, this is where mockery becomes very useful. And the more pity that we project onto them, the more uncomfortable they become. And so it can be hard. Like, that's a really difficult place to get to. And so you don't have to engage with all of them, and ideally, we have enough people around that someone else can engage with most of them, and just every now and then, when it seems right, you can step up. The consequences also tend to be a lot lower for guys who step up and call guys out. And so the more guys we can convince to practice these things and that if they don't say anything, the sexists are going to think they agree with them, the further we can get on this one. And the next step is to make it about you. This takes even more confidence than the last one because you're putting yourself out there. But on the other hand, the favorite tricks of sexists is to make it about some generic woman who could never actually be a person. She's some object over there that they're interacting with. And if you instead make it about yourself, suddenly they have to deal with a real woman who's standing right there, or a real anti-sexist man who's standing right there who doesn't agree with them, who is challenging their worldview, who is a counterexample to whatever terrible generalization they've just made. This works especially well if you encounter the evolutionary psychologists. It's unfortunate. And this is one way we can change the conversation from being about not driving women away, or protecting women, or making women more comfortable, to being about our own standards. We can make it about making, I don't agree with what you said right there, and I don't want to be a part of a community that tolerates that behavior. And so it becomes about me. And so they can't argue back that, well, some women are fine with this, because as soon as you say this makes women uncomfortable, you will find the woman who has stuck around because she loves this stuff. She loves being just one of the guys. You know, women are misogynist sometimes. And so the more we can make it about ourselves, the further we can get away from this notion that there has to be some monolithic entity, women, to which we are catering. Because there isn't. And we're always going to run into the fundamental problem that some people don't agree with us. And that doesn't make us wrong. Right, and the lack of women in computer science is really like the canary in the coal mine. It's not the ultimate goal to have more women in computer science, I don't think. I think that will be a side effect of having a healthier computer science community and a better science. We can make our profession a place where we are proud to be a member. You know, it's kind of awkward sometimes. You're like, yeah, I'm a programmer. And I'm actually really proud of what I do. But it can be hard to convey that to people because what they see is, you know, Stallman. And the bad behavior that we tolerate in our public personas. And if you do this, you'll be called too sensitive and probably have every other derailingfordummies.com approach thrown at you. And you just have to be ready for that and know that that's about them and not you, and they can go deal with their stuff because the world's changing around them. So making it about me, what do? I belong, right? I'm a programmer. And that's a political statement, right? There's not some definition out there that says this is a programmer and these are the qualifications you must meet to be a programmer. When we say I'm a programmer, I'm asserting that whatever that category is, I'm part of it. And there's lots of other people who will try to redefine it to exclude those people, right? So just like there's no magical category of women, that all women experience the same way, there's no magical category of programmer that all programmers experience the same way. I certainly was told when I was starting out that you are either born a programmer or not. You know, you have to love this so much you forget to eat. And I think these are terrible stories, because in fact, maybe poets make great programmers. I certainly think that they do. And maybe we want to attract people who believe themselves to be poets and also write code. And so this defensive, like, I'm a programmer and I have to justify that, leads to all sorts of terrible things where I'm alienating the people around me. Anytime I say, well, my first computer was, or I started with, or I've been around since, I know that I'm trying to do some power play, basically. I'm saying I belong here, and I don't need to say that because I belong here. And so instead, what I've taken to doing instead is asking other people what they know that I don't, and being interested in whatever that is. And that makes them feel included. And then all of a sudden, it's not a contest, because we can both be programmers. And plus, I get to learn fun stuff, you know. And really, the fact that I'm interested in their discussions of the use of metaphor while writing Haskell says I'm a programmer, right? So you get there. I admit my ignorance when I don't know something. This is pretty radical, I think, sometimes. But when we admit that we don't know things, it means that other people are free to admit that they don't know things. And then we can do more things because we don't have to know everything all the time. And actually, Google's really good at knowing everything all the time for us. And then I don't do everything. I choose where I spend my time and which assignments I take on, and then I only take on a little bit more than I can do, because there's a lot of cool stuff out there. But self-care is important and radical. And then I try to support other people's belonging. And the way I do this is I listen to them, and I see what they want and what they need, what they're asking for, and I allocate some of that time that I have to supporting whatever that is, because I don't know. Yeah, this is one of the things I don't know, is what other people, what would help other people. And I think we need to hack society because we can, right? As long as we tolerate the status quo, we're choosing to tolerate the status quo. Donna Haraway is a cyborg feminist. She has this amazing poem, essay, manifesto, a cyborg manifesto that I love. And this is my favorite line from it. I'm a sun worshiper mediating a new scientific revolution. We get to choose what the future looks like. We get to build it out of nothing. And it's amazingly cool, right? She goes on to say that ultimately the heart of science is about the realm of the greatest boundary confusion, the realm of pure number, pure spirit, C3I, cryptography, and the preservation of potent secrets. And this is why I love feminism. Is because we get to talk about things in language that, if we're clinging to science and objectivity, we'll never get to engage with this. We never get to understand the sheer power we have when we choose to consciously build these communities. But all of these other definitions, all of these people who say that this isn't a programmer or that's not a programmer, or if you don't use Vim or Emacs or whatever, that's a political claim. They're laying a claim to my profession. And I'm here because I see the potential for genesis in this profession, in these machines. I don't want to grant their premise that I'm an interloper, that they're the normal people and I'm something weird. I've been here from the beginning. Right? When we tell our stories of Ada Lovelace and the Edenic girls, and Grace Hopper, and Adele Goldberg, and Barbara Leskoff, and ourselves, we're reclaiming this realm of wizardry that they're trying to take from us. This field is ours, as much as it is theirs, and we have every right to demand and insist on our continued inclusion and comfort, right? Ease at work. And we're not starting anew. There have been lots of other fields that have gone through these similar problems, similar changes. Ours are different. We have the whole front and back end thing that, you know, most other places probably don't have. We have our tension between the pointy-haired manager and Dilbert that we're getting in the middle of and telling them they're both wrong. You know, it's not a novel problem, though, and we don't have to pretend it is. We can do whatever it is that we can reach out to our history of activism as well as our history of technology to address these problems. We aren't alone unless we choose to be. Feminists may seldom speak our language, but we seldom speak theirs. And I wasn't born knowing bits and bytes, right? We learn new languages, that's part of what we do. And I think we can learn this one and take it to amazing places. And this is why we also need to get together and build community around this, because alone we only have our own experiences to go off of, and it's inevitably going to be incomplete. There are going to be people left out if we build our interventions just on what I want or what you want. The people, those of us still here, are already self-selected, right? If the things that were keeping women out were going to affect me the way they've affected other people, I wouldn't be here. And so building alliances can bring in feedback and strengthen our power and validate our approach. And if you don't have a community around you, find a feminist community or find computer scientists who are reluctant allies who you can build into a community. I found science fiction conventions to be incredibly useful for this. And one last thing, we are brave. There is backlash for all of this. You know, I know people who have had the cops show up at their door because people on the internet have called them, DDoS attacks. There are all sorts of terrible stories. And I tell these things not to scare you off, but to show that we can tell these stories and it's okay. Right? Our stories aren't going to drive people away. Girls are smarter than that. They already know what it's like. They can go look it up on the internet. And all we can do is change that. We don't get to say that you shouldn't be afraid. We can say you're afraid, and that's all right. Feminism taught me not to be afraid of my fear. The fear is rational, right? Like, there are going to be consequences. We can either accept that we will be afraid and work until we aren't anymore, or we can hide ourselves away. And I'd rather fight. Even if we're good and quiet and never complain so we don't scare away the suits or the money or the next generation of targets, we will still get pushback. If we speak, we don't have to be afraid alone. We don't have to let other people remain comfortable while we're afraid. We can share it. Patriarchy won't go away if we pretend everything is fine, so instead I will fight tooth and nail to make it fine. I'll tell my generation and the next and the previous that we don't have to put up with it. We can insist on healthy workplaces and healthy work environments and create amazing software. I will be an inspired political cyborg and cultivate the digital community that I want. The strength of my fellowship with other feminists is what brought me to stand here before you today, and I hope I can share that with you and see all of the amazing technology that you build in the future.